I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Christopher Yeomans, professor of philosophy at Purdue University. We're discussing his recent book, The Politics of German Idealism, from Oxford University Press. Yeomans' research is on Kant and post-Kantian philosophy, and especially political philosophy. He is the author of many articles and two books on Hegel. Well, first of all, Chris Yeomans, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, for having me. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, Chris, I love the book. Thanks for writing it. It's a great analysis of some core texts in political theory by Kant, Fichte, and Hegel, and setting them in a historical context in a really illuminating way. So good work on the book. Let me first of all ask you what the motivation was for writing the book in the first place.
Yeah, so this is a classic Chris fell down the rabbit hole story. All I really wanted to do at the beginning is figure out Hegel's theory of the estates. I thought this was going to be one paper, and I had this very naive view about the historiography that I could read some historians of that German period and figure out factually what the estates were, and then I could see whether Hegel's view was accurate or not. And it didn't take me very long to realize that I had completely misjudged the scope of the problem. But it had some wonderful consequences of tipping me into a set of figures in German historiography like Reinhard Koselleck that were just extraordinarily valuable to me. And I first went to Koselleck, really just the Habilitationsschrift, Poison, Zwischen Reform and Revolution, just to try and get a handle on the historical facts, as it were, and really stumbled into the view about historical time as part of it. But it was in once I realized you couldn't really figure out what the estates were about until you figured out until you saw this sort of triangular split that the state was pulling away from society and these two different versions of society were pulling away from each other. Once I sort of got that picture from a variety of people like Koselleck, but Quentin Skinner's got that picture too. Once I got that, it started to illuminate these other really strange doctrines like Kant's provisionality doctrine, like Fichte's antinomy of punishment. And so sort of by accident, I lucked into this historical perspective trying to figure out the estates. And it just turned out that it illuminated these other things as well. So really, a lot of it really was just sort of following the scholarly side of it. Also, sort of at the same time, I had started teaching my graduate seminars in German political philosophy topically instead of chronologically. So instead of doing Kant, Fichte, Hegel, I would do a property week. And here's a week on family, and here's a week on the legislature, and so on. And of course, to some degree, you lose the internal connections in the text. But boy, does a lot come into relief. And you can see much more easily Kant, Fichte, and Hegel as sophisticated variants of political positions at the time that are in conversation with each other, which I have found a really interesting way to teach it. So that was all sort of happening scholarly, and this was all happening really sort of in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis and then into these events that culminate in, you know, 2015, 2016 in the United States, in Germany, in Italy, in Spain, and so on. And it felt like we came out of a sort of period where, whether we liked her or not, we all kind of agreed with Margaret Thatcher that there was no alternative to capitalism. And we were just hoping that the future would just be a little bit better than the past, but would more or less be the same, into a period where it just doesn't seem like what we're doing right now is sustainable at all, and that we have to have something new. And part of the historical surprise that pushed me further down the rabbit hole was realizing that that's the position that Kant, Fichte, and Hegel are in. That even in Kant's lifetime, everybody's looking at the Holy Roman Empire thinking, there's no way this thing is still here. How can this still be our political system? And then you get into the early part of the 19th century after the Napoleonic Wars, and it's clear that Germany has to modernize, it has to pay these war reparations and so on. And so I thought I saw in the German idealists something that very few people, I think, have seen, namely a set of political philosophers who were intervening in political debates at a time when everything was on the table, except going back to the past, right? And so I thought, if I could really try and tell that story, then there's going to be some general features of the conceptual apparatuses that they develop that might be valuable for contemporary political theory.
That's great. And I loved, and as I mentioned already, the sort of setting of the historical context of these thinkers, among other things, in the book. In part, as you know, the tendency in our profession is to sort of extract the arguments from their historical embeddedness. So it's nice for you to sort of set them back in there. Can I ask you to begin maybe by just saying a little bit about what you take to be the most salient or significant sort of historical context for thinking about Kant, Fichte, and Hegel's interventions here? I'm thinking about, sort of what the kind of major social, political, economic trends were that they were responding to and they were critiquing and setting out to reform.
Yeah, I mean, one way of putting it is to talk about it as the state building period in German history, right? That you're coming out of the Holy Roman Empire, which has something like 250 constituent political units, right? Everything from Prussia and Austria to, some knight in a valley, all like those are all states, right? Those are into the period of the German Confederation, where I think it's 22, 25, something like that, after the Napoleonic Wars, where you're actually getting something with that are building outstanding armies, that are building out more state courts, that are obviously building out taxation systems to support those standing armies and so on. And so part of the story is to consider these forms of political philosophy not so much as responding to given state structures, but intervening in the process of the first development of those state structures. And along with those state structures comes a new sense of the individual who is responsible to those state structures and to whom those state structures are responsible. And so, particularly in the legal reforms that are so important in this state building process, like the Prussian Allgemeines Landrecht from the late 18th century, what you really see in lots of those places is like philosophy of action being done in these legal codes as they try and figure out the different ways that I'm responsible in my local village court, in the canon law court of the church, in the criminal court of the state, how these different jurisdictions are related to each other, and so on. And so you have this period in which the legally responsible subject is really first being built as a practical project of government. And so this is happening, like I was just mentioning, to my mind, as this very dense fabric of normative relationships that characterizes early modern European society, and particularly German society, is pulling apart into three separate spheres or kinds of those relationships. You have this traditional Ständegesellschaft, is what you would say in German. It's really hard to have an English translation of it because the English-speaking countries didn't really go through the same history. So in French, you can translate it as the Société des Ordres, The Society of Orders, right? We generally translate it as corporate society, but of course we don't mean IBM or Siemens or things like that. But the older corporations like the guilds and the manorial farms and the churches and so on, these institutions that had their own privileges, their own essentially legal systems, right? And it's interesting to note, this is the world in which Kant lived his whole life, right? He comes from the family that was involved in the guilds, and he goes right into the university, which was its own sort of guild and corporation in that way, with its own sets of norms and laws. So you have that on the one side, and then starting to split off is this new civil society, right? Bürgerliche Gesellschaft. You're starting to get the coffee houses and the Masonic lodges and the newspapers and the reading groups on the one hand. And on the other hand, you're starting to get these new forms of economic production outside the guilds, various ways of running manorial farms so they produced a surplus for the market rather than simply distributing it among serfs or villagers and so on. And so you have these different forms of association that are primarily voluntary. Right? The forms of association in the traditional corporate society are largely involuntary. People, you know, marry their second cousins and live in the place where they grew up and don't go very far away. And then you have the civil society where things are far more voluntary, maybe even anonymous, like the Masonic lodges and so on. And so you get these very different kinds of norms and forms of association and very different senses of what property could be like. And then also, then you have these states that are being built that are trying to encourage civil society, but are also trying to build out professional administrative corps, trying to formalize legal procedures so that you can get the kinds of settled expectation that make economic growth possible. And so I really see that splitting in the formation of these three basic social perspectives in that period as being the most important social change. And so that becomes then this, not only this social network of perspectives, but a kind of conceptual network that I then use to map the different theoretical approaches that Kant, Fichte, and Hegel take to different institutions.
Right. And so they're, Kant, Fichte, and Hegel are trying, if I'm following you, to sort of develop the conceptual language for making sense of these new social orders, and particularly the relationships, the new kind of relationships, because there's a kind of, this is something we get from Hegel, right? A differentiation that occurs in the modern age where state and civil society split apart. And the question then becomes how to think about a logic of how to integrate them back together, right? They just can't. It can't exist sort of separate from one another.
And this is a problem, I think, that in the general outlines hasn't left us. This worry that the social fabric is tearing and the worry that we don't have leadership or institutions that can try and like stitch it back together, right? And hold people in the same community. So, you know, post YouTube, we worry about political polarization and so on. Obviously, the groups are different, but I think you're right. I mean, Hegel is trying to develop a conceptual vocabulary for talking about that project.
Right. And so just to give this a sense of the overview of the book has three parts. And the first part, you talk about sort of foundational your sort of foundational analysis of the concept of legal standing or what it is to be a sort of legal subject at all. And then you talk about the application of that in the private realm and then the public realm and then in parts two and three. So I thought we could start about with the sort of foundational matters. In the first chapter, you talk about Kant and particularly his notion of provisionality, which is really central to your analysis. Kant uses this term provisional right throughout a lot of his political philosophy. So what does he mean, or what do you take him to mean, sort of provisionality, and what's the significance of it in your view?
Yeah. So conceptually, I think the significance of it is it's an innovation in a kind of normative validity that is irreducible That is contrasted with what's usually translated as conclusive right, but the German is peremptorisch. We have this English word peremptory, lawyers use it, right? A peremptory challenge is one is that then if you win it, it's like beyond appeal, you're done talking about that sort of thing, right? And so the development of these two kinds of normative validity, this provisional normative validity, right, which is valid but inconclusive, it is defensible and yet valid only in anticipation of something else. And in particular, its defensibility and enforceability depends on its not getting in the way of its potential improvement. So there's a mutability and a changeability that is built into the very appeal to this kind of normative validity. That contrasts with the kind of conclusive or peremptory of normative validity that would be beyond change, beyond challenge, and so on. And I think that this articulates the historical experience of modern states that are constantly trying to improve their laws, that are constantly trying to make their laws more definite, respond to new situations and so on, but which are always responding to normative claims that are based on both earlier versions of the law and on non-legal social relations, right? There's an important sense in which provisional right is pre-political for Kant. Right? It's a matter of the kinds of social relationships that we quite legitimately have outside of politically enforceable relationships. And I think Kant's point is both these earlier versions of the law and these, as it were, pre-political social relationships generate legitimate claims to things, legitimate claims to choices, and legitimate claims to statuses. Right, that have to be recognized, but their legitimacy is bound up with their mutability. And so in claiming, hey, you know, this is my pen, hands off, I am ipso facto making a commitment to modifying my claim to the pen to make it a more consistent part of an overarching series of claims to property, right? That would be responsive to the universal principle of right and so on. And so I see that conceptually as identifying a different source of validity that speaks historically to this beginning of the pull apart between society and state, and starting to see that we have these non-state derived forms of validity that we need to make appeal to, that nonetheless have to cohere with the state-derived forms of validity. But Kant's very interesting in a kind of negative way. I mean, there's these passages where he's talking about provisional right, where he goes, you might think even overboard and say, look, all the content of civil law and public right is going to come from these provisional rights. Right? That's where all of the content comes from. And all that the laws do is make this consistent and enforceable. In those moods, he sounds like Locke, right? I think that's more than what his view actually is. But he doesn't think we should make the provisional claims that are most leading to the conclusive or peremptory claim. Because he doesn't actually think we know what the conclusive and peremptory claims are, that we can specify that clearly as an ideal. And so what we have to do is make these claims in this sort of intermediate status where we're willing to reconsider them if negative evidence comes to light, as it were, that these are in some form or in some respect incompatible with a conclusive set of rights. And so it's this form of normative validity, I think, that tracks this historical process. I think that sometimes think of it as, right, this synchronic sign of a diachronic process that Kant's really there at the beginning of. And I really struggled with the provisionality doctrine until I saw that. So it puts me in a very small group of Hegel scholars, including my Purdue colleague, J.P. Messina. So maybe we have to call this the Purdue view. I don't know. Who also thinks that it's Kant's view that provisionality is interminable, right? That it's not a state of nature issue that we get beyond in a threshold that we cross to get into the Republic, where we're approximating the ideal of conclusive right. No, it's we're always in this like double vision. We need this stereoscopic vision for any kind of rights claim, where we're getting the content and our investment from the provisional side of it, but its validity depends on our being willing to modify it in the future, as we try and make it consistent with other sorts of claims.
Yeah, I might be more on the Lisa Ellis side of things. Let me just say a little bit about how I understand her view, and then you can say because I think what you last said was interesting. I mean, I do think that the legitimacy of positive law for Kant has to rest on the possibility of improvement, of progress, right? That if it is the case that you have a regime where positive law is not going to improve, or it's sort of immutable, it's never going to change, this is going to be contrary to right. So there is, I guess I sense a sort of teleological element in provisionality. Do you see a teleological element of provisionality?
Or yes, as it's there in Kant's philosophy of history, but in a very negative way, right? In the following sense, that Kant's quite skeptical, other than generalizations like the development of all of our talents, of saying much that's contentful about it. Right. And so he'll say things like in the Enlightenment essay that no state of culture can be considered final. Right. We can never consider ourselves to have achieved that end goal. And you see the same thing in provisionality. And this is why one of the reasons that I think it's irreducible is provisional right is not a means to the end of conclusive right, at least not as far as the intention of the individual agent is concerned, right? In terms of some sort of cunning of reason, as Hegel would put it, in terms of the way that the natural purposes of humanity make use of our unsocial sociability, sure, these provisional rights conflicts that we get into inspire the development of better legal systems and promote us in that way. But the teleology is not something, as it were, that you can directly take on as a justification for your own provisional rights claim. The most you can say for your provisional rights claim in a teleological sense is, I don't think that this hurts the chances of our developing a better form of conclusive right or a more conclusive form of right. So it's very similar to the indirectness that I think you get out of Kant's view of public reason, where like we should just turn people loose and let them write whatever they want in the journals and have some like basic confidence that over the long haul, that's going to be beneficial to the reform of laws and society. But he's not looking for a real direct connection. So I do think that there's a teleology there, but it's interestingly, I think, not built into the first person intentional stance of the person making the provisional rights claim.
Yeah, I guess maybe another way to put my question is that, I guess put it in these terms, that there's a way in which modern political thought, social contract theory, the doctrine of natural rights from Locke and so is a very revolutionary doctrine, right? In the sense that, as you were saying, sort of if you believe in the idea of freedom and equality of all human beings, this is going to radically upend traditional society. And I think one way to understand the provisional right on Kant's view is that it's a kind of concession to traditional modes and orders, right? In the sense that, yeah, you know, I'm Kant. I was the author of this like radical doctrine and pure practical reason, but theory and practice have to go together. And so I'm going to develop a doctrine where I'm going to say, yes, those traditional modes and orders are provisionally right as we make our progress and move towards a republican order of freedom and equality. In other words, it's a more, rather than a revolutionary doctrine, it's kind of evolutionary step-by-step doctrine that allows us to sort of defend the validity of certain traditional modes and orders based on the sort of teleological direction of human history. So
yeah.
Does that fit? Does that square with your reading?
Yeah, I would just, I guess I don't, there's one way of saying concession that I think that's right, and one way where I would disagree. So it's a concession to historical reality in a way, I would say, and a concession almost to what I would call the need for content. Right. In the same way that when Hegel is introducing ethical like and Sittlichkeit, he introduces it with this problem that, like, look, you can have all of these abstract notions of property from the doctrine of abstract right, and that's not going to help you promulgate law for actually producing firms and farms and families and how to build a legislature and so on. And though Kant himself does not have the great interest in institutional design that Fichte and Hegel do, I think he has enough interest in the kind of social basis of our rights, claims, and investments to realize that that's a necessary part of the story. And I also think this is, one could say the same thing in this sense of concession about the other piece of Kant jargon that I pick up on in that chapter, which is this auf dingliche Art persönliches Recht, right? The thingly right to persons, which is the right that spouses have against each other, parents and children have against each other, and perhaps most importantly, the head of the household and the servants have, which I read as a kind of very limited defense of private jurisdiction in addition to the public jurisdiction of the state. And this is another place where you might think, hey, the early modern political doctrines were very radical. And the one thing, I don't know, not the one thing, but one thing that both liberals and civic Republicans would seem to agree on is that the distribution of public authority as if it were private right is the definition of corruption and what is to be avoided. On the other hand, a couple of centuries later, we have made almost no progress in eliminating forms of private authority from modern democratic societies. And you might think that a theory like Kant's that tries to theorize the subordinate place that it might have within an overarching republican theory gives us better resources for dealing with the problems that, you know, like Elizabeth Anderson calls private government and Chris McMahon calls public capitalism, than the more sort of radical state-only approaches, right? Which obviously after the totalitarian regimes look a little different as well. Right. So on both of those places, on the one hand, I think you're quite right to say this is a kind of concession. On the other hand, I think it provides a way of really normatively theorizing a historical problem that has not left us and does not seem likely to leave us.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little, I'm going to turn to Hegel here now, but it's a little like Hegel's, the way he kind of reforms thinking about social and political institutions, which is not, you know, there's a kind of brute objective institutional world out there, and there's our subjective reason that we just sort of use as a measuring stick against those things. But actually, those social and political institutions are themselves sort of embodiments of sort of rational categories that have developed over time. It sounds a little bit like Kant is, you know, in your view, he's kind of developing that in the sense that, you know, these institutions sort of carry or are enabled by kind of reason, but they also are sort of incomplete in their rationality. Is
that historically particular? Yeah, right. I mean, in part because so much of normative validity has to do with reasonable expectations, right? I mean, lots, you know, that might, if it's not the most important thing about the rule of law, it's one of the most important things about the rule of law is that it stabilizes expectations between people so that you can cut down on the level of violence. I mean, it's just Hobbes, right? And so those expectations have to be taken up into the legal system in some way. Right. And this is what the Allgemeines Landkreis tries to do. The vast majority of it is just trying to figure out like these. It identifies a variety of different kinds of norms and tries to systematize them and say which belong to which courts and which jurisdictions and which trumps which and so on. So I very much attribute to Kant this insight into the difficulty of normative theorizing in a historically transitional period. He doesn't really yet have the distinction between corporate society and civil society, and he's just not that interested in institutions. But the general form of the problem, I think Kant's got that insight.
That's great. Yeah. So let's talk about Hegel and the legal responsibility. I take it, you know, the shift here is thinking what synchronically rather than diachronically, right? We're talking about the sort of historicity of the development of right and the provisionality view of Kant. Yes. But Hegel also attends, which Hegel's, of course, attentive to, but also he's attentive, as you bring out quite well, the sort of pluralism of a kind of legal responsibility, legal accountability for the legal subject. And you bring this out through a reading of very difficult sections in Hegel's philosophy of right on morality, set against the background of, as you were saying, the Allgemeines Landrecht. I'm not sure how to best proceed. Maybe just if you want to talk a little bit more about the Allgemeines Landrecht and then how Hegel's sort of morality views and morality were responsive to that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth saying just how modern a form of law the Allgemeines Landrecht is. And, you know, it's not alone. There's versions of this in other German states and in Austria and so on, these attempts to promulgate something written. So there's, on the one hand, an incredibly naive hope behind it. Frederick the Great really did think if you could write down the laws clearly enough, we could get rid of lawyers because nobody would argue about these things anymore. And lawyers was just a waste of intelligence and training. That didn't happen. But here's what's fascinating about it. So it is first released in draft form, essentially, as the Allgemeines Gesetzbuch, I believe is what it was called. And there's a period of public comment on it, where scholars and affected groups weighed in on the provisions and so on. And then after a period of public comment that was a number of years, I can't remember off the top of my head how many, it's promulgated in a more or less final form. And so it has some of the, the same structure, the same process as modern lawmaking has, particularly in the administrative state, right? Where, you know, if the FDA is going to promulgate new rules for, I don't know, drug discovery or proving that drugs are safe or something like that, they're first going to put out a draft and then they're going to receive public comment and then they'll put it out and so on. And, And after the initial hopes that this would finally solve all the problems go away, it just simply becomes a topic for reform and a target of reform, particularly then as we get later into the reform period after the Napoleonic Wars. And the other feature of it that I think is really important is its very concern to identify what I think we would now call different normative competencies, right? So including, for example, the normative competence to decide whether something is actually a topic for moral judgment or not, the moral competence to make all things considered judgments, the moral competence to understand the way rights and welfare are related to each other. And if you look at various points in the Allgemeines Landrecht and these other laws, you can see bits that are trying to set out what we would now think of as conditions for different kinds of responsibility. And I think that that is the kind of background from which to read the morality section of Hegel's Philosophy of Right. So just like on the provisionality topic, I should flag for your listeners that I'm in the minority on this kind of interpretation too, but I view the three sections of the morality chapter as not being the teleological development of the final form of responsibility that everybody has, but rather setting out in a more pluralistic way three different forms of responsibility that maybe in some sense in different conditions we would all be responsible for, but that in Hegel's social theory, he thinks by and large pattern on to different kinds of life. The agricultural life for the first one, the commercial life for the second one, and the sort of administrative and government life for the third one. Right. So I don't actually think Hegel thinks most people are ever going to be in a position to make all things considered judgments about, for example, whether grain price controls are a good policy or not. Right. He thinks there's going to be some very few highly educated bureaucrats and maybe some people who have studied farm economies who are going to be able to know about that. What most people need to have is a kind of basic set of responsibility for the things that they caused and intended. But I very much see that in these legal reforms. So that's what I try to get out in that chapter.
Yeah. So is there, I'm just trying to think through this. I mean, is it connected? You're suggesting it's connected with his estate view.
Yes.
The morality section, which is an interesting view. I hadn't exactly thought of that. And so each one.
Well, I will say this, and here's another point. That's in the lectures. If you look at the examples that he's giving in the lectures, it's pretty clear that when he's talking about the first form of responsibility, and now look, he has like these idealized views about farmers and so on, right? I'm not here to say that this is like detailed empirical sociology that's going to pass muster in, 2023, but he has these sort of Weberian ideal types that come out in the examples, I say, that he uses in the lectures.
Right. No, I mean, that's good. I mean, it's a pluralism of sorts in the sense that it's a sort of pluralism within any particular society, but it's not. So what you're suggesting, it's not a pluralism within our kinds of moral judgments themselves, like that individuals themselves wouldn't have sort of competing ways of thinking about legal accountability, that it's like different individuals would have their own particular kinds of, views of legal accountability, and somehow the institutional structure would kind of bind them together.
I think that's Hegel is thinking about it. I think that's right. Yep. And the institution has to bind them together. That's right. And the institution has to say these are all forms of moral responsibility that amount to holding free people accountable for their actions, even though they look different. Yeah, to holding the pluralism together.
Right, Right.
That's so it wouldn't be responsibility. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the usual thing where at this point, I'm not sure if I, you know, leave the bus with Hegel. I mean, in part because it's strikes me that there's much more, I guess, conflict even at the individual level about what, how to think about, I mean, just to take the two examples about the right to knowledge and the right to intention. Yeah. I mean, these different kinds of forms of moral agency seem to pervade, you know, our moral lives. They don't just, you know, they're not just connected with particular estates and in society. What do you think? Do you,
I mean, so I think part of that is part of that I want to say is more is true of 21st century people for reasons that make it plausible to think it's probably not true of early 19th century people. And these have to do with the extraordinary development of education, right? Number one. And number two, the extraordinary development of the market, right? And so if you think of education as bringing with it the right of insight into the good, and the market as bringing in the right of knowledge, right? You can see really that in the early 21st century, right, what you're getting is a combination of things. But 80% of the population in 1820 is illiterate, unlikely to ever leave the valley or small region in which they were born, likely to work on the same manorial farm that their parents did, and so on. And so I think there's much more of a claim, at least for that first estate, for the ideal type to be more limited in the way that Hegel suggests, right? It's more complicated in the second two estates, in part because lots of the representatives of civil society are in fact government bureaucrats, right? This was true of lots of the estate assemblies and so on. So, but look, in a way, I think for Hegel, the most important thing is to distinguish these as three different types of responsibility. If it turns out that they pervade our moral lives, and it is nonetheless the case that for each of us, one of them more or less dominates our personality, as we might say, then I think that would mean that about 90% of Hegel's view is true.
I mean, I do think it thinking about this more, I mean, it is true that even in our lives, we have distinctive forms of responsibility that are connected with our jobs and our occupations. I mean, you and I were talking before this, we're both department chairs of our programs, and we have, you know, distinctive kinds of responsibilities that our, you know, our colleagues don't have, in the sense that we have particular kind of roles that we play, but also, you know, certain kinds of norms that of expectations on our activity, yes. For better or for worse, for us, probably for worse, but
I think we're called to make all things considered judgments in a way that our colleagues aren't necessarily in certain, right? I don't think it's appropriate for somebody, for example, in a department chair role to, as it were, stand on their rights in the way that it might be perfectly appropriate for a student or even a staff member to do so. So yeah, I mean, and in lots of ways, I think for Hegel, the connection with roles is the most important part. And the estates theory you might think of as just a a coarse-grained version of attributing these kinds of moral responsibilities to certain sorts of social roles.
Good. Yeah. So I thought we could switch to the second part of your book. Yeah, sure. on private rights. You discuss the family, property, and inheritance here. We won't have a chance to talk about all of them. I didn't know if you, if the family or property, in your view, were Which one do you think is the better
illustrator? Probably talk about Property.
Let's talk about Property. Yeah, because that's great. So yeah. So let's you, in these chapters, and I should say, you talk about Kant, Fichte, and Hegel, sort of along the topical, right. thematic lines, and which brings out, I think, nicely this sort of ways in which their theories converge and also mm-hmm. diverge, and set against the backdrop of this sort of changing social and economic circumstances. So maybe we could talk through, the views of property. Part of the background of the story in the property chapter is this sort of debate about constructivism in ethics and political philosophy. So maybe if you could, talk about that background and then what you take to be sort of the Kant, Fichte, and Hegel's contribution here.
Right. Yeah. I mean, in a nutshell, I would say, I think the contribution they make is that to constructivism is to make it clear that the question of what citizens could or would or could not agree to, that is, this constructivist question, is essentially a historical question. And both because of pre-existing social expectations and because of the actual political, economic, and personal impact of certain kinds of property rights on certain kinds of economic arrangements at certain forms of economic development, right? I think this is, in a way, in some ways, clearest in Kant, paradoxically. I'll just introduce the contrast here, though I think Kant's view on the family is essentially the view of the older traditional society. And the view of the family he offers us isn't even what in German you would call a Familie or a Kleinfamilie. It's what you would call a house. It's like parents and children, but also servants, and it's an economic entity. So that's like from the past, but his view about property is absolutely of the future, because his view about property is just there can't be any unprincipled restriction on what you could own. Like, I really do think that's the extent of Kant's view of property, which is in a way perfect for the developing commercial society that precisely needs a flexible conception of property to develop the myriad of ownership interests that get developed throughout the 19th century, including ownership in these strange things called shares and corporations. That's sort of what you need to do that. And I mean, Kant's essentially saying there's no principled limitation to which we would agree, right? Or could agree. Similarly, in Fichte and Hegel, you get different versions of this. So I very much think Kant has this economic view about property that is the perspective of civil society. I very much think that Fichte has an essentially political view about property that is the view from state building, right? Because for, and I know you talk with David James about this in your podcast, for Fichte, the most important property right is your right to earn a living by your own hands, at your own profession. Why? So that you can be an independent citizen who can play some role in the polity. Right. And that's why we're going to have, for Fichte, we're going to have these constitutional conventions, and I'm going to agree that you get to be a tailor and you're going to agree that I get to be a blacksmith. But my agreeing that you get to be a tailor is my promising to buy my clothes from you. And your agreeing that I get to be a blacksmith is your promising to bring your horse to me to, make horseshoes and things like that. And so there's this other kind of property, right, where we might have books or pens or something like that that wouldn't be that important. But the main form of property is my ability to earn a living in order to show up as a citizen, right, as to be really independent. And then it's complicated for Hegel because Hegel takes a lot of that Fichte on board. Hegel has really two conceptions of property. In that chapter, I really focus on the part from abstract right that is the German term Eigentum, which is just like this Eigentum is just like something's your own, right? It's a very general term. And but the once you get into civil society within ethical life, what's really doing the work is this term resources, Vermögen, which you might even translate as capital in a like lower C sense of capital. And Vermögen is very close to the Fichtean notion, right? That's my right to resources are really my right to have the family farm to earn a living, or my right to be able to use my skills in a corporation to support myself and be part of the team and so on. But in Eigentum for Hegel, it's very much about personal appropriation of the body. So quite unlike Kant, who thinks the view is ridiculous, Hegel thinks, no, you have to take possession of your own body. That's the first piece of property that you have to take possession of. So in all of these, I really see the historical predicament that they're in an attempt to say what would be reasonable. Right. I mean, maybe I'll just say one more thing about Fichte, is that Fichte is very clear in the closed commercial state that the only way we're going to guarantee these kinds of property rights that will enable citizenship is if we close the borders and maintain an essentially subsistence economy. He's very clear-eyed about what's required for a planned economy. And that is essentially no new needs, right? Like it's okay if you need 2% more grain next year. That's quantitative. Maybe we can like figure that out, but we're not going to get new needs. And so there's, I mean, you know, sorry, I'll say one more thing and then I promise I'll stop. But it connects with things that Montesquieu and Hegel also thought about ancient Greek democracy, which is it worked in Athens because they were also poor, right? And as soon as you start getting people with money and property rights, they're not citizens in the same way, right? So anyway, that's what I think of really is the complex of their thoughts about property relations.
Yeah, that's helpful. I tend to think of this tradition as sort of set against the or setting themselves against the Lockean tradition and thinking about private property rights, that is sort of rooting private property in a pre-political normative framework. That is that famously in Locke and in the Second Treatise, sort of develops an account of the acquisition of private property that's based on a sort of mixing your labor with the land and it becoming part of you and so forth. And so that private property is possible, in other words, in the state of nature. For Kant, Fichte, and Hegel, Fichte especially, I mean, very much rejects that this view about, you know, sort of right to things. Kant also, that it becomes much more of a kind of right to, as you were saying, a sort of right to kind of activity. In concert with others within a civil regime, which
A
sort
right
of,
to a kind of social relationship.
right, exactly, right to a, you know, so it's about, you know, relations among people rather than people's relation to things. And I, you know, I mean, what I guess one of the questions I had about this is, you know, it's at least in the Lockean view, it's a little maybe more straightforward sort of how to resolve property conflicts, right? You could sort of point to, well, I mixed my labor with this stuff, so it's mine.
Yeah.
When it comes to this sort of social relations, I mean, social relations can be kind of messy. They're the
Yeah.
claim, they're the claims of the community against the claims of the individual.
Yeah.
Fichte, I think, you know, sort of systematizes this in his view of relative property, which is the property
Yes.
that sort of belongs to the community versus absolute property. What belongs to me? It's never been clear to me, like that he has an adequate account of that distinction, right? Like absolute property, it seems to be like whatever I have in my house, right? It's like, wait a second, what if I just hoard all my money in my house? So, I mean, what? How do you think about, I guess, maybe the sort of tensions between sort of communal property and more properly private property, and whether these German think what these German thinkers have to sort of contribute or say about the tension between those?
I think it's very active. And I think one can easily overread certain kinds of criticisms of communal property in Kant and Hegel in particular as being rejections of communal property entirely. So both Kant and Hegel are quite critical of large, primarily church landholdings, right? And foundations that didn't serve people's economic needs, and but were also not particularly grounded in any kind of economic activity that naturally reproduced itself. And for Hegel, this, is bound up with his general anti-Catholicism. But it's easy to overgeneralize those things. Because I think for all three figures, they see that what kind of social relationship you have a right to when it comes to property, is partially based on what pre-political social situation you have, including just where you happen to live and what productive resources you happen to have at your disposal, but also the pattern that has to be created to satisfy the even the high-level general principles like the universal principle of right, or like Hegel's Rechtsgebot, to be a person and treat others as persons. And I think all three figures recognize that there's no non-controversial way to specify that abstract pattern. Right. I think my own view is that Kant goes the furthest in this direction and wants to say it's in principle impossible from our limited historical viewpoint to say what that is. Because if we could, then we could freeze culture and we could stop and have the laws that we have. I think Fichte is, on the other hand, the most inclined to think that he's solved the problem and can specify what that is. But he's then also the most clear-sighted about the kinds of sacrifices that are going to be have to be made. But even for Fichte, he recognizes that when we close the borders in our closed commercial state, we are going to have people who have contracts with people on the other side of the borders who owe money and are owed money. And we can't just treat that as if it's null and void. Like we have to find some way, maybe we don't make them whole, as you would say in contemporary law, but we find a way so that they're not destroyed by that process, right? And I think Hegel thinks, in a kind of meta-level move, the ideal form of the state is the conversation about the ideal form of the state. And you have to set up these different estates, these different groups, so that they're constantly talking to each other about that. So, yeah, it's going to be a lot more complicated than the kind of Lockean story. You can't tell the kind of, historical story that, like Nozick says, we have to tell. Like, stop talking about distributive justice. Just like trace back the series of claims to this piece of property. Were they legitimate? Did somebody steal it from somebody? Right? You can't do that on, I think, either Kant, Fichte, or Hegel's account.
But it's also not going to be a kind of Rawlsian principles of justice that you can develop either, right?
That's
Or
right.
a
Yeah,
kind
that's
of
right.
even a Walserian spheres of justice type of view. It's like more complicated than Walzer, I guess, as I'm
I think
understanding, because
that's right. It's more
this,
historical. There's the pluralism
right.
of Walzer, but there's more this sense that, yeah, but that person lives on that farm. And if you take them off that farm, they got nothing else to do, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's helpful. I wanted to turn finally to thinking about the public right.
Oh yeah,
and you talk here about Fichte and Hegel. You got to, you know, zero in on Fichte and his sort of political philosophical system that you trace from the foundations of natural right up through the addresses in your chapter on him in an interesting way, and thinking about how, you know, Fichte essentially tries in those three different works you discuss, the foundations, the closed commercial state, and the addresses of the German nation, to think about three different kinds of temporality, right? The past, yes, present, and the future.
Yeah.
And how each of these kinds of works helps sort of illuminate the sort of possibilities for the development of right. So maybe you could, you know, sort of talk through that interpretation.
Yeah, sure. I think these works are just fantastic. And obviously the addresses are controversial for really important reasons. It's a foundational text of German nationalism. And there's all sorts of debates about whether Fichte's nationalism is really linguistic as it appears to be on the surface, or it has in fact a biological element. But putting that aside, I do think, particularly in the way that Fichte describes the relation between the foundations and the closed commercial state, in the closed commercial state, you can see him playing with these different temporalities. And I think it's clear that he thinks of the foundations as what Koselleck calls the horizon of expectations, which is something like the future made present. And you can just feel it on the page in Fichte that he knows that this is possible because it's a priori necessary, right? And so he's so frustrated that it isn't there, like it's just on the other side of this veil, right? And if people could just like have some gumption, you know, you could get there. And obviously, I mean, you see this in all sorts of radical reformers in political movements all over the place. This is just so simple, right, to get there. But it's very much, Fichte is clear that in the closed commercial state, that the picture he's telling in the foundations is an a priori picture about what would have happened if you started from nothing, right? Right, where you still have to summon people to be free and so on. And so it is, in a way, it's a kind of like speculative fiction, right? It is a kind of like science fiction about a possible future. The closed commercial state, quite the opposite. He wants to tell this historical story about what the past has transmitted to us that makes the problem of the present so pressing. And the story that he wants to tell, of course, is that what you had originally in the continental Europe, or maybe the German-speaking lands, was no states, and kind of one big market, because nobody stopped you from going any particular place. And what we've been doing so far is chopping that up into states, but the market remains whole. And so what you get is this disconnect between economic sovereignty and political sovereignty. But then Fichte sees you can't guarantee people in the property rights that they deserve unless you have economic sovereignty, right? And this is very clear-eyed, but it is also very much, this is this particular problem which German history has given us, which we have to solve if we're going to get to this future. And so that I very much take to be what Koselleck calls the Erfahrungsraum, the space of experience, right? And then what you get in the addresses and in the characteristics of the present age, which are, they're funny bookends, right? Because the characteristics are right before Prussia's defeat to Napoleon, and the addresses are right after. And you would think he'd be optimistic before and pessimistic after, but no, it's the opposite. Before, all he can do is complain about decadent Germans, and they just don't have the gumption because they're like an addict that hasn't hit rock bottom yet. But after the defeat, he feels like, no, this is rock bottom. Now we can actually, come on, my fellow Germans, we can actually build these societies that we've talked about. But of course, the means are even, putting aside the nationalism, the means involve various forms that are familiar from kinds of 20th century totalitarianisms, right? You're going to have these re-education camps where you essentially take the most talented students out of their families and use Pestalozzi's educational tools to make them true idealists who are not bound by the past, but can project the freedom into the future. And that's the one estate that works with their mind, and it is the job of the other estate that works with their bodies to follow the estate that works with the mind. So there's a whole bunch of history of radical movements, avant-la-lettre, that's contained in Fichte. But what you can never accuse Fichte of is downplaying the nature of the changes or the nature of the price that needs to be paid. He's an extraordinarily clear-eyed radical, and I think there's real value in that, in bringing out. But that Fichte was able to take these three positions, I think, and set out. I mean, even the language of the three sets of texts are very, very different. And fascinating, and I think fills out Fichte as a political philosopher and gives you a richer sense of what's going on than you get from just the foundations.
Yeah, I was thinking about, we've been talking a lot about sort of Kant, Fichte, and Hegel together and a lot of their similarities. I think, some of what you just said makes me reflect and think that there's one here that's not like the other, in the sense that Fichte is a lot more radical than Kant on the one hand and Hegel on the other hand. It makes me think that Hegel's responding in part to Fichte and trying to domesticate him a little bit. I don't know what you think about that characterization, but in some sense, Fichte fits a little less, is a little less congenial with your theory. And maybe you tell me why this is wrong. But in the sense that he's much more, he seems like much more impatient and insistent with the progress of history, moving history forward. A lot less patient with the provisionality of history, a lot less patient with pluralism and so forth. That his outline for example, the political economy is much more sort of state controlled, state centric, and once you eliminate the aristocracy, you get this already from the French Revolution text early on in his career. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm suggesting that Fichte might be a little bit further away from Kant and Hegel, I guess, with regard to some of the things that you're discussing. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually think in different ways, all three of them are limit cases, right? But I mean, to my mind, that just sort of means they're the the points in the triangle, right? Where you can really see the sort of full extension of the field. So I think the fact that even Fichte, and I think your characterization is exactly right, who just cannot wait for the future to happen and runs through all of his personal relationships with lack of patience for those who do have patience. Even he is forced at those points when he is making contact with the historical present to find ways to accommodate provisional right. So this point about the closing of the borders is one place that that happens. Another place that it happens that we don't really have the time to talk about is in this antinomy of punishment in the foundations, which I puzzled over for 15 years before I finally felt like the historiography told me what was going on there, that what you really get is the difference between the state courts and the private courts and the different approaches that they have towards responsibility. But I also feel like, in another way, Kant is a kind of limit figure because of the kind of negative approach that he takes towards this teleology of history, that he's sort of willing everybody not to get in the way, Right? But there's nothing like the Hegelian, hey, here's how you could design some institutions that would be the motor of history, right, in a way. And then Hegel, in his own way, becomes a limit case too, because as I sort of put at the end of the book, in some ways, the provisional and conclusive right switch places, and conclusive or peremptory right just becomes abstract right. A kind of like high-level discussion that we're already always having that kind of refines some generalizations about what we're actually doing. But all of the action is at provisional right and setting that out in a certain way, and designing the institutions so that you accept their kind of interminable provisionality.
That's great. Yeah. So let me ask. Let's conclude. Let me ask you, I guess, one more time to sort of put them all together again, and maybe
Yeah, sure.
reflect. In your conclusion, you talk about three sort of, I think, enduring contributions of this tradition: the sort of provisionality of politics, pluralism of politics, and historicism. So maybe so sort of, what do you think the big sort of takeaway contributions of this tradition are?
Yeah, for each. I mean, again, I think for provisionality, I'm coming to grips with that as a sui generis normative status that is, as it were, a kind of index of the historicity of the situation that you're trying to describe, is a kind of deep insight that Fichte brings, or sorry, that Kant brings, and that in various ways gets played out. But I think holding on to that as a way of doing, as it were, non-ideal theory that isn't at odds with ideal theory, right? I mean, so if I'm right about Kant, there's a non-ideal and an ideal theory, the conceptual resources for them put into contact with each other. And that, I think, is a really powerful notion and a powerful idea. And it's, to my mind, also a way of, as it were, accommodating some of the insights of political realism without giving up on a kind of robustly conceptual understanding of what the validity of political norms might be like. And so that's why I'm so excited about it, for lots of the ways that Ellis is too. You were mentioning Ellis before, that this is a kind of theory of political judgment that I do think in various ways Kant and Fichte sort of take up. And then the pluralism part of it, I really, one of maybe the unique things about the book is I don't really at any point say, well, we ought to take Kant's view about property and Fichte's view about family and so on. I'm not convinced that that's the level of normative argument that political philosophy ought to operate under. So in some ways, this makes me more of a Hegelian than a Fichtean, certainly, as Hegel, declines to tell you lots of things. But I do think that political philosophy can play an important role in trying to surface the kinds of conceptual structures that are involved in reasonable pluralism in the political sphere about different institutions and norms. And that this is a really a contribution that philosophy can make. And then just the historicism, I mean, again, going back to the time period in which the book was written, sort of post 2008 and then post 2016, right? I do think a rec more of a recognition of the complexity of our historical moment, and doing political theorizing in the context in which you really do have groups of people, some of for whom like the pace of social change is just too fast for them and they can't wrap their heads around it, right? And other groups for whom it's just too slow, right? These effective accelerationists, right? And so on. I think that that's that those are important fault lines that a lot of political theory of the last quarter century really just missed. And it really put us on the back foot once, you know, the 2008, 2015 sort of things happened. And I think surfacing that again at least makes us live to those kinds of issues when we're doing contemporary political philosophy.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for this great conversation and for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Yeah, thanks for the questions. Really appreciate it. Thanks for the invitation.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.